Hello, everyone. This is Coach Freddie here. I'm a lifestyle coach. I'm here with David Bush. He's an attorney here in Colorado, in the Denver area. And as a lifestyle coach, I inspire people to do the things that inspire them. Build an inspired business and create an inspired lifestyle. My mission in life is to help people get so clear about their dreams and their vision in life that they just want to jump up and dance. They want to leap out of bed each morning and get the show on the road. So I coach entrepreneurs and business owners on how to adapt the triple bottom line business model. It's people, planet, and profit. I coach them to have a personal vision, a mission statement for their business that benefits people, helps the planet, and provides profits. I coach them to live a healthy lifestyle and to take care of themselves. They have to put themselves first before they can take care of anybody else. You know, and I coach them to play the game of life as if it were an Olympic sport. You know, I inspire people to do the things that inspire them and build a business and a lifestyle beyond their wildest dreams. Now, industrial hemp meets the triple bottom line format. It can provide millions of jobs for people in the U.S. and all over the world. It can rejuvenate the planet. And by growing hemp, industrial hemp that uses less water and no harmful chemicals or pesticides and grows in almost every climate. Every state in the United States can grow hemp. It can be used to make thousands and thousands of products and produce billions and billions of dollars in long-term profits. That's people, planet, and profit. A triple bottom line. Now, most corporations use the single bottom line. That's profit. Now, an A corporation has a fiduciary responsibility to provide a profit to its shareholders. That's it. And the shareholders aren't concerned with the people or the environment. Their only concern is a return on their investment every quarter. And I think, David, that's an A corporation, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
An A corporation? Well, there's something called a B corp, which is...
Well, the B corp is the triple bottom line, correct?
Yeah, well, a B corp is a relatively new creation. The idea was to broaden the purpose of corporations and the duties of the directors to the shareholders and to others.
Okay.
So if by A corporation you mean something traditional before there was this concept of E corporation, I would definitely agree with what you're saying here.
Okay. Well, David, you know, when we first met, one of the things that impressed me was that you believe the practice of law is about solving problems reasonably, ethically, and professionally, and that you seek to find creative and proactive approaches to help maximize opportunity while minimizing the risk of conflict. And I thought that was unusual for an attorney, but I like that, you know. And I know you've been practicing law for over 25 years, and you've worked for the Denver District Attorney, the Colorado Attorney General, Minnesota Courts of Appeals, and you've worked with for law firms in Minneapolis and in Denver. And in January of this year, you opened your own law practice, David Law. Now, that's in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, correct?
It's in Wheat Ridge, yes,
okay.
Just west of Denver.
And you're specializing in working with industrial hemp, the industrial hemp industry. So, David, could you give us a little bit of more of a background on yourself and how you got started in industrial hemp and why industrial hemp?
Sure. Well, in my years of practice, I've been primarily what we call a civil attorney. I've had very brief experience in criminal law, but that has not been a focus of my practice at all. So I have been a civil attorney. I have been working in the area of litigation, which is in conflicts, really most of my career. Most recently, I was 15 years with a law firm downtown Denver. where all we did was civil litigation. The way I got into hemp was last year there was a significant change in management in our firm, and it led to a lot of self-examination about where we wanted to go in the future, what kind of practice we wanted to have, and we started exploring the possibilities for some new areas of practice. And let me just jump to the end of the story. The upshot was it didn't quite work out the way the firm had anticipated, and almost everybody ended up leaving, including myself. All of the staff left, and all but one attorney who was there besides the management itself ended up leaving. So the firm is completely transformed into something, and I don't even know what that is now. But back last year, I was with everyone else, and we were examining what do we want to do with ourselves. And I had a curiosity that had been there all along in industrial hemp. It was just kind of a faint thought in the back of my mind, and I never really explored it. So that was the curiosity component. The friendship component was, it just so happened that last spring, I reached out to a friend of mine that I hadn't seen in some years. He's an attorney practicing in California. And it was just a casual email I sent him saying, hey, we haven't seen each other in a while. I was wondering if you had any plans to come in by Colorado and perhaps we could get together. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I am. I'm coming for a conference in Aspen, and I want you to come out and meet me there. It turns out this conference was for Normal Legal, for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and there are a number of lawyers in that organization, and they have two conferences a year. One of them is in Aspen. So I came out to Aspen really to see my friend. It wasn't for any other principal purpose, but I was still in the back of my mind curious about industrial hemp. When I got to this conference and I was looking at some of the literature for Normal, I realized that they had three major purposes. One was, this is all in the matter of legal reform. One was recreational marijuana, and that's what they're really, really known for, recreational marijuana legal reform. The other was medical marijuana, and a third was industrial hemp. So one out of three purposes of this organization was to promote the reform of laws that were prohibiting industrial hemp. Okay, well, that got my attention. And I thought, wow, I'm here with literally 150 lawyers, best of the best, cream of the crop from around the country. These people really know about cannabis. And so these are the people that could tell me something about industrial hemp. You know what I found?
What did you find?
Nobody knew anything. Here was, I just have to emphasize that this was a conference of the cream of the crop, the best of the best, the smartest lawyers, most accomplished lawyers in cannabis law around the country at this conference. And they didn't know squat about one of the three supposed purposes behind Normal. Okay, well, what that hit me with is, gee, maybe there's some potential to practice in this area of law, and maybe I could become a pretty smart guy in it because I'm with a whole lot of smart people and they don't know anything. So I came back to Denver from that conference, kind of galvanized to learn a little bit about industrial hemp. I joined some organizations. I joined the Hemp Industries Association. I joined the Rocky Mountain Hemp Association and Normal, and started networking. And during that period of time, as I said before, our firm in its present form fell apart, and almost everybody left, including myself. I decided, well, here's the opportunity to try something entirely new. And that's when I formed my solo practice in January of this year. And the principal focus of my practice is business law for the industrial hemp sector of the economy in Colorado and around the country.
Well, that's great. I think that, everything that you do, you know, there's no such thing as a coincidence. So you leaving the the practice that you were in before gave you an opportunity. You know,
somebody meant this to happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everything okay. Everything happens for a reason.
All right. Well, then.
That's why you're
there
here
you go.
Today. That's why you're here today, David.
Perhaps that's why I'm here this morning, right?
That's it.
Yeah, this must be for a reason.
Well, you know, what I like to do is, you know, can you give us a brief history as to the laws concerning industrial hemp and marijuana? Go back a little while and... you see, my understanding of the law that was passed for marijuana and the industrial hemp was a controlled substance. It wasn't passed to protect people. It was passed to protect corporations. Big corporations were threatened by the many uses of industrial hemp. And, you know, for giving an example, paper, cotton, steel, oil, timber industry, they were all threatened by industrial hemp. And what's your opinion on that? And, you know, why were these laws passed?
I'm not sure I believe what you just said. So let me go back to that. There are stories out there about industrial hemp was suppressed because of big corporate interest, in forests and tree paper products and plastics industry. I really get the sense. I've read those stories. I've never seen any hard documentation for where they came from. They seem to be stories passed around and passed down. And I just really have some doubts about how true they are and how relevant they are. Yeah, sure. There's always going to be interest in one industry contrary to another.
Right.
I'm sure the wool growers and the cotton growers are at each other's throats all the time. But the fact is that both industries do survive. They still produce their products. They compete with each other. So what? There's competition all over the world.
Right.
I am not really convinced that the reason that hemp hit hard times, and we'll talk about that in a minute, I'm not convinced that really has very much at all to do with competition from other industries. That may have been part of it. That doesn't really sit well with logic in my mind.
Okay, well, why do you think that the industrial hemp, if it's, you know, there's no harm to anything, why was it put into the marijuana regime? What is your opinion on that?
Well, my opinion is that the reason we have prohibition is because we're a Puritan nation. And let me go back to that for a minute. We do have certain outlooks as Americans that are a little bit different than the way a lot of people look at things around the world. And we do have a Puritan tradition in this country. And part of that is in our attitudes about sex and about intoxicating substances, that we have tried to regulate those things in our society. That they have been at various times looked down upon. And so when you look at the prohibition of marijuana, and let's start with that, that began in 1937.
All right.
Okay. That was not many years after the end of alcohol prohibition. And I never hear anyone talk about that. And truly, I believe that if you understand that sequence of events, that is far more important than talking about, oh, there was some guy who owned forests and wanted to make tree paper. That's just competition. That happens every day. But our Puritan tradition is shot through our society from top to bottom. So we had, 10 years of prohibition? More than that. It started in 1919, right after World War I, and it went until the beginning of the Roosevelt administration, 1933. That's when prohibition of alcohol ended. Mm-hmm. Okay, you think the prohibitionists went away? Heck no. They were still there, and they probably were madder than heck that their cause célèbre that had risen to such a fever pitch in the late 19th century and finally had its realization in 1919 with national prohibition of alcohol, they still wanted to prohibit. They just lost that battle. And the unfortunate thing is America didn't learn its lesson, did it?
No.
Because what we had in a matter of a few years after the end of prohibition, we had a brand new prohibition, and it was called drugs. All right? I see some fundamental continuity there, and I think we need to look at things and think about them that way. All right. So you asked me about history. And why don't we talk about that a little bit, the history of marijuana prohibition and hemp. All right. Prohibition of marijuana started in 1937 with enactment by Congress of the Marijuana Tax Act. And it was one of these insidious laws that it didn't exactly outlaw marijuana, but it required that anyone who wanted to possess it, grow it, transport it, pay certain taxes, and they had to really get authorization from the federal government. They had to basically get these stamps on their products. So the federal government could control the production, processing, distribution of marijuana simply by refusing to issue such stamps. So, in effect, marijuana became illegal in 1937. Before that, there had been quite a bit of cannabis grown around the United States. And by cannabis, I'm referring generally to marijuana and hemp. We can talk about that, too, in a bit. But there were some sizable hemp industries in the United States, particularly in the southeastern portion of the United States and south central. But 1937, that became illegal. And the definition of marijuana was so broad in the Marijuana Tax Act, it swept in everything, including industrial hemp. And so the entire industrial hemp industry was thrown out at the time that prohibition jumped from being prohibition of alcohol to prohibition of drugs, including marijuana. That happened in 1937. Let me fast forward to 1970. The Marijuana Tax Act was in effect for about 33 years, from 1937 to 1970. What happened in 1970 was President Richard Nixon was on his campaign of law and order. Remember, this was right after the 60s and all the turmoil we had in our country. Everybody was sick of rioting. They were sick of racial tensions. They wanted everyone to behave themselves. So we had the law and order ethos that arose in the 1960s. Richard Nixon was one of the big champions of that. And part of that was to revise the drug laws in this country and put them under a comprehensive Controlled Substances Act, which was enacted in 1970. Okay, here's what's interesting, or perhaps depressing about that, is the same archaic, problematic definition of marijuana that was used in the Marijuana Tax Act was carried over almost verbatim into the Controlled Substances Act. There's a difference, a slight difference in punctuation in the middle of the definition of marijuana, which doesn't affect its meaning. So we've had the same all-encompassing, huge definition of marijuana since 1937 in this country that has been so broad, it swept in industrial hemp, and it has prohibited recreational marijuana, medical marijuana, and ruined the industrial hemp industry, which we are now trying to bring back. So that's my summary of the history.
Okay. Well, you know, that's interesting that, you know, how that all got swept in together. And it's unfortunate that had happened. And so let's fast forward to today. And what are some of the hot button issues in the industrial hemp industry?
Well, the hot button issues for industrial hemp, they really are tied up with marijuana. We have to talk about them together.
Yes.
Because marijuana and industrial hemp, they're really the same plant. So they're both varieties of the genus cannabis. And so most of the attempts at legal reform we see, even if they say they're about hemp or they say they're about marijuana, they really affect the entire cannabis industry to some extent. And hot button issues go the same way. So some of those hot button issues, let me start with taxation.
Okay.
You may know that we currently have a organized crime law at the federal level, and it's been repeated in many state jurisdictions. It's called RICO at the federal level. Colorado's version is called COCA, but they're organized crime control statutes. And those were enacted starting at the federal level in 1980. The idea was to be able to indict people, not simply for directly committing criminal acts, but for conspiring with others to commit criminal acts. Why do we have that? We have that because there was a lot of organized crime, has been, of course, all along, but there was a surge of it, by the way, starting with Prohibition in the 1920s.
Yes.
Huge blossoming of organized crime in this country. Why? Because we suddenly had an illegal substance, alcohol, that criminals could make a big racket out of. You had organized crime that was doing all kinds of things, and it was very, very difficult for the United States government or any jurisdiction to bring these people down. You'd have Al Capone committing all kinds of horrible crimes, murder and extortion and so on and so forth, but his lieutenants would do it, not him. He ordered it, but he covered his tracks very well. The result was it was very difficult to bring down the kingpins. Very difficult. And so that's why you hear about some of these big crime figures in the 1920s and 30s. What did they get arrested for? It was tax evasion. It was perjury. It wasn't for committing the criminal acts that they really affiliated with. Okay. And so I talked about RICO and statutes in Colorado like COCA, because those were created in response to that problem. But in any event, one of the other responses was for the governments to say, well, hey, we can't bring down these crime figures directly. We don't have laws on the books to bring them down. But what we can do is make them pay their taxes. We can do that, and we can indict them when they fail to pay. Even if it's taxes from horrible criminal activities, we can make them pay taxes on that, and if they don't, we can put them in jail. Okay, so there was this system that arose then, earlier part of the 20th century, to charge taxes to people engaged in organized crime. All right, well, one of those was drug racketeering. That still exists today. Mm-hmm. That's where it came from, and it still exists today, that people who are involved in criminal enterprises to process drugs, distribute them, okay, that's an illegal activity. They shouldn't be doing it at all under the law. They can still go to jail for not paying their stupid taxes on income they earn from that. All right, and I say all this because what we have today is a lot of legitimate enterprises that are dealing in what traditionally were drugs. And I'm talking about hemp and marijuana.
Okay.
All right. They have a big issue with taxes. Why? Because the government taxes them like they're still criminal enterprises. The motivation in the past was understandable. Al Capone was getting people shot up. Okay, he was extorting people. He was controlling police departments, doing all these horrible things. And taxes was a way to get him. And they did. They got him. Okay. Unfortunately, now you have people trying to run a legitimate medical marijuana establishment. They're trying to grow hemp on a farm. And what are they confronted with? The same nasty tax system. Let me tell you what the tax system is, very simply. There is a regulation in the Internal Revenue Code. It's called 280E. And what regulation 280E says is, for certain criminal enterprises, including drug racketeering, you're going to pay taxes in a way different way than ordinary citizens do. And that is, we are not going to allow you to write off your business expenses. You got to pay taxes on everything except what they call the cost of goods. I'm not going to get into the particulars of that. We need a tax attorney on the show here to talk about what all that means. But here's the upshot is taxes are incredibly high for cannabis industries. Not because they're criminal enterprises, but because they're getting taxed like criminal enterprises. It's somewhere I've heard on the order of 70 or 80% of their income is taxed, which no other corporation, no other business in the world, at least in the world of the United States, has to pay. But cannabis does, and it's very painful, and it's very debilitating, and it needs to change. So that's one of the hot-button issues.
Okay.
And I talked at length about that because that's one of greatest concern to all cannabis, including industrial hemp.
Well, that's interesting because I've heard that story, but not as in-depth as you told it, and I'm thank you for that. But those laws have to be changed to make this a viable industry. because nobody's going to get into it and be taxed that. It's not going to sustain itself.
No, it's not sustainable. And especially as you may have seen in Colorado, at least on the marijuana side, hemp, it's too early to tell in most respects. But on the marijuana side, prices are going down. Simple supply and demand. Yep. That there's more marijuana hit the market and demand has not been keeping up with it. So for those of you who buy marijuana, I'm not one of them. I don't really bother with the stuff, but there's plenty of people that do. And they tell me that they're paying prices now that are perhaps half of what they were a year or two ago.
Yeah.
So prices are going down. Taxes are still very high. The margin that someone can earn in a cannabis business on the sale of cannabis is not changing. But the price that they're getting in at the door is lower. What that means to me that they're earning a lot less profit. So that's going to hit a breaking point at some point. I don't know when. And so there is a lot of pressure, a lot of activity right now in Washington to try to get cannabis out from under regulation 280E, to tax it like ordinary businesses, not like criminal enterprises.
Well, yes, we have to do that. There's another issue that... that I want to bring up, and I know you know some things about that, is what about the seed certification program? Because I know other industries have certified seeds. Can you enlighten us on that?
Yeah. And let me give you a little bit of background in that. Hemp has started from zero in Colorado. There wasn't a hemp industry before Amendment 64 was approved by the voters in 2012, and the industry really didn't get going until last year. 2014 was the first full year of legal cultivation in Colorado. Okay, compare that to marijuana. There's always been marijuana grown in Colorado, always. I mean, at least within memory of many decades here.
Oh, yeah.
It was underground, okay? There was lots and lots of marijuana being grown in the country, being imported. And I say that because what's important to think about is because there is a long history in this country of growing marijuana, legally or illegally, there's been a lot of experience with growing it. There's been a lot of experience with breeding. And so there have been good cultivars of marijuana around for a long time. And, of course, the activity that's going on in breeding and developing new cultivars has only picked up since legalization. But you had an infrastructure in place. And so when marijuana became legal in Colorado, all you had was people who were underground coming above ground, so to speak. All right. You didn't have that in hemp. You had people above ground, always were above ground, saying, gee, I'd like to try this. What does that mean in terms of how you get started? In marijuana, there was plenty of material around to work with. In hemp, there wasn't diddly. All right, so where do people start in hemp? Well, they had two choices. One was to essentially commit a crime by smuggling hemp seed from places where it was legal, such as Canada. Okay, in Canada, nationally, hemp has been legal since 1998. A lot of Canadian hemp seed found its way illegally into this country. European hemp seed found its way illegally into this country. Other way that people got hemp was to go out and collect feral, I mean wild hemp growing. Feral is basically some species that was once domesticated and is now on the loose. So there's feral dogs, feral cats. There was a big hemp industry at one time in this country, and now you have a lot of feral varieties growing in Colorado, in Nebraska, all over the country. People were going out to ditches, to abandoned fields, and finding feral varieties of cannabis growing, which usually would be industrial hemp, not marijuana, and they would collect seeds. And so those were the two sources that people had to start with in Colorado, were these feral seeds they collected and then some seed that was brought by hook or by crook, usually by crook, into this state from elsewhere. Okay. You asked about seed certification. Here's the problem we have with hemp. Nobody knows what they've got. Why don't they know what they have? Because every hemp seed out there, generally speaking, is a mongrel. It is a mixture of junk that people collected from feral plants. It is some Spanish seed that was smuggled into this country, some Canadian oil seeds, some Chinese fiber seed, and it's all mixed together. And so you have this mess of a mixture of lineages and varieties in what people are trying to plant and grow as hemp in this country, or in this state, I should say, particularly in Colorado. It's real difficult to plant a business that way. Think about that. Any other business, you ought to know what you've got and what you're going to come up with before you get started. That's just common sense. If you're going to be making canned beans, you better know what the beans are like and what the cans are like and what the beans in the can are going to be like. Okay, fair enough. It's hard to do that with hemp. People don't know what they have. So you ask about seed certification. The idea behind seed certification is, A, we need stable cultivars in Colorado. We need to know what we have. And B, we need to have truth in labeling. We need to have some consumer protection so that when people buy stuff, it is properly labeled to say what it is. And it really is going to be what it says it is. That's the idea. And with that, let's say someone wants to grow an oil seed variety of hemp. The idea is they should be able to purchase or otherwise, you know, trade, barter, I don't know, acquire seeds that have a pedigree that will tell them, if you grow me, I'm going to be an oil seed cannabis. Number two is it's going to be a cannabis with a very low concentration of THC, so it meets the legal requirements for industrial hemp. Hey, right now, it's kind of a crapshoot, guessing game. People hold their breaths when they plant because they don't know if what they have is going to be hemp or marijuana, and they don't know what kind of hemp or marijuana it's going to be when it comes up. The seed certification program, it was just authorized by the General Assembly of Colorado this year. June 5th, it was signed by Governor Hickenlooper. And what that did, this is S-196 is the bill that was signed by the governor. It authorizes the state of Colorado through the Department of Agriculture to, for the first time, create a seed certification program for industrial hemp. And I will say there are some other state laws, I've started to look at those, that require that seed be certified. They don't say how. They don't have a program. Yeah. We're the first ones, I think, that are really going to have a seed certification program. If you want, I can talk a little bit about the particulars of the program, but that is the motivation for it. It is to create something. It's to try to catch up with marijuana, frankly. It's to give us something we know we have and to be able to actually create a business model from the seeds that we acquire.
Okay. Well, that's good. And I want to talk a little bit about the laws again, the federal laws and the state laws, and how they affect each other as far as industrial hemp is concerned, to transport. You know, for the industrial hemp to become a viable industry, you have to be able to ship the crop, you know, from state to state, just like any other crop. Corn or wheat has to be shipped here and there. And there are laws into effect. Can you tell us a little bit about the federal laws, the state laws, and do they conflict with each other?
Well, they do conflict. The answer is absolutely yes. And that's a whole topic unto itself. Let me just say very briefly, the source of the conflict is that some states, and we can get into particulars of which ones are the some, but some states have some degree of legalized industrial hemp production, cultivation, possession, distribution. Federal government, with one narrow exception, and I have to emphasize it's one and it's narrow. With one narrow exception, the federal government doesn't recognize any industrial hemp as legal. It prohibits it all as part of marijuana. So that's the fundamental conflict. Government says no way, and some of the states like Colorado are saying yeah way. So anyway, that is a question about the conflict, but then you were asking about transportation, I think?
Yes, you know, going across the state lines, there's the federal laws, I think, says you can't go across state lines.
Sure. Well, what we have is a fundamental principle, something called interstate commerce, and that has been around in American jurisprudence since we created our Constitution in 1789 and approved it. And that is the idea that within each state, there are state laws that govern. When you start doing any activity between states, that's called interstate commerce, and that okay. is of direct federal concern. The federal government, Congress, is authorized to regulate. I think the Constitution literally says something like commerce among the several states.
Okay.
Meaning yes. that if there is a good that is being sold from Colorado to Massachusetts, the federal government may regulate that transaction. It's authorized to do that as a matter of national concern. The way that comes up with industrial hemp is it arises from the very conflict I just talked about, that the federal government says no way and states say way. And so you may have one state like Colorado that has legalized hemp production. And then you try to ship those goods to another state, and it may violate federal law. It may trigger a interstate commerce concern by the federal government where they would say, whoa, you're breaking federal law by selling those goods from Colorado to Massachusetts. And that, in fact, is a great risk that is present now, especially in the CBD market.
Okay. So, yeah. You and I had a discussion a couple days ago about the local controls, and we're talking about Colorado here, the local controls, and some of the districts or the small cities have put some restrictions on industrial hemp and marijuana. Can you give yeah. us a couple examples of that?
Sure. I can give you a couple examples. Let me give you just a quick background, and then we can get into a okay. couple of examples. Hemp and marijuana are defined as different things in Colorado. Not federal level, but mm-hmm. in Colorado they are. They're defined as different things, and they are regulated differently. One of the basic differences between the regulation of marijuana and the regulation of industrial hemp is that marijuana, both the state constitution and the state statutes, provide very emphatically that local governments, counties and cities, have tremendous control over that industry. That someone may obey all the state laws in Colorado to have a marijuana establishment, but if their locality says, we're not going to allow this, what the state constitution and state statute say is that's okay, they can prohibit it. In fact, they go one step further. What they say is you can't do it. You can't have a marijuana establishment unless it is expressly authorized by the local jurisdiction. They may have to give you their own license. So that's enshrined in law. Okay, now turn to industrial hemp. Sorry. Industrial hemp, we have a state statute, and it says literally in the state statute, the registration of industrial hemp is a matter of statewide concern. Those aren't just words. That was put in there for a very specific reason. Couple that with the fact that there is zero provision in the state constitution or the state statutes that says local governments have the right to control the hemp industry. Doesn't say that. So the fact that it's a matter of statewide concern is this is a matter for the state to regulate. The fact that there isn't any provision for local governments says local governments don't have any special rights like they do with marijuana. So the general rule comes down to this, is if you obey all the rules for registering to grow industrial hemp or to possess it or process it or distribute whatever you want to do. The general rule is counties and cities can't get in the way. They have to stand back and let you do it. Very, very, very different from the marijuana regulatory regime. Now, here's where there's kind of a gray area, and that is there's still local regulation. There's still matters that are of local concern, and the biggest one is zoning. The counties and cities always have the right to zone activities.
Correct.
And here is the big question that is going to be present in the examples I'll give you is, to what extent can a local government employ its zoning powers to regulate industrial hemp without running afoul of the general state law, which says this is a matter of statewide, not local concern. All right, here's the two examples. Example number one, city of Denver. And I need to provide a little basis for this, too. There's three kinds of legal creations, I guess, for marijuana. Okay. Number one, recreational marijuana. We all know about that. Number two, medical marijuana. Those two are regulated by the state agency in Colorado called the Marijuana Enforcement Division in the Department of Revenue. There's a third one that's kind of the odd man out, and that is something that arises under the Colorado Constitution, which says anybody has the right to grow six plants for their own use, as long as it's indoors, locked up, and it's no more than either two or three flowering plants out of the six. I forget which it is.
Okay.
But in any event, that third one is not an activity regulated directly by the state. Okay, not regulated directly by the state. And what we have is there's a lot of people that call themselves caregivers who will raise marijuana plants for people who can't do it themselves but need to use the plant for some medicinal applications. They're called caregivers.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the three. There's medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, caregivers. City of Denver was concerned that the caregiver business was out of control, that there was too much marijuana being grown by caregivers. Some caregivers had hundreds of plants that they were raising for their patients based on this six plants per person allowance, okay? City of Denver enacted an ordinance which limited plants not regulated by the MED, and they meant the caregiver plants, to 36 in any one establishment. 36 okay. plants. Okay, fair enough. Here's the problem is that, again, the definition they used for marijuana was so broad, it swept in industrial hemp. And so the upshot is, in City of Denver, not only are caregivers limited to 36 plants, any commercial hemp operation will be limited to 36 plants. And let me tell you, no one's going to run a commercial hemp operation with 36 plants. They need 360 plants, not 36. Okay, not going to make any money with 36 plants. So the effect is, in Denver, by passing what was a well-intentioned ordinance, they have effectively ruled out any commercial hemp production within the city limits. That is a significant issue. If not economically, it's legally anyway. A significant concern. There has been some talk about possibly filing a legal challenge to that ordinance on grounds that this is an improper regulation, essentially a prohibition against industrial hemp by a local government that has no authority to do it.
Yes. Here we go again. Prohibition, right?
Yeah, prohibition. That's right. Our Puritan heritage. God bless.
Yeah.
Let me go to the second example. Okay. Second example is Pueblo County. Pueblo County has a very strong marijuana industry, and it has become very well established, and many would say very well entrenched in the county. Now, there is a issue that has arisen, and, you know, to this day, I'm still unclear. And in future shows, we're going to have some guest on that will help us understand it better. But it's this. The issue is cross-pollination. It is where you have a male industrial hemp plant. And keep in mind that most cannabis varieties express themselves with distinct male and female plants, just like people do, just like a lot of species on our planet do. A lot of plants are male and female, and cannabis is one of them. What the ordinance motivated by was marijuana people saying, hey, we don't want people growing industrial hemp, having male plants that send off all this pollen into the air that then starts pollinating our marijuana flowers and messing up our production. And now that's a very, very loaded issue in that, and I will admit to you, I have some understanding of it. I don't understand it very well, and I think there's tremendous misunderstanding in general about it. We're going to learn more about that. But for now, let's just say marijuana industry perceived that as a huge problem. So they went to Pueblo County and said, well, we need a zoning ordinance. And remember, I told you, zoning is one thing local governments can do. The extent of that zoning, I'm not sure. Pueblo County said, fine, what we're going to do is this. Number one, we are going to put a ban or a setback requirement on any industrial hemp grow in our county of 5 miles if that grow is going to include male plants. Okay, they have to be 5 miles from any marijuana grow, unless, and here's where it really gets vexing, unless the growers of marijuana within that 5 mile radius say, okay, we'll allow it. So they're turning the law over to private citizens, which I've never heard of. I mean, there was a lot going on during the Great Depression with Franklin Roosevelt's administration trying to do something similar, and the Supreme Court shot them down every time. You can't delegate legal authority like that to private individuals to run their own laws. And that's exactly what Pueblo has done with the setback requirement, is they say you can't do it unless some other private growers who happen to have interests different from yours say it's okay. Good luck. Have a nice day. That's one problem. The other is the same zoning ordinance says if you want to grow indoors, if you want to grow indoors and you want to have male plants, you can't have them in a greenhouse. Well, guess what the most economically efficient way is to grow indoors is in greenhouses. So number one, that's a strike against any grower.
Yeah.
Further, they say, okay, so the building indoors that you have can't be a greenhouse. It has to be, I don't know what, a bunker? They don't say. But then you have to employ state-of-the-art facilities to control the pollen. So they put all of the burden, 100% of the burden, on the hemp growers to control the dispersion of pollen from their male plants. The effect of this, of course, is that there is virtually no industrial hemp growing in Pueblo County. People can't do it because of the setback or because of the owner's requirements for indoor grows. The only ones that benefit from this ordinance are, number one, of course, the marijuana industry, and number two, the CBD industry, because those people only want to grow female plants anyway. That's where they're going to grow buds and flowers to get the CBD extracted. So they may have some benefit from this, but anyone who wants to grow hemp for any other reason, whether it's fiber, oil seed, fuel, building materials, all of the many, many uses for industrial hemp, they are effectively shut out of Pueblo County. Is that legal? I think not.
Yeah.
And there's talk about raising a challenge to that as well if the ordinance doesn't change. Those are the two examples.
Okay. Well, thank you, David. Okay, let's take a little break here. And we'll be back shortly.
Okay.
Okay, we're back. This is Coach Freddy, inspiring people to do the things that inspire them. And we're here again with David Bush, the attorney. And David, before we left on the break there, can you clarify about the greenhouses? Because we were talking about Pueblo County, and this is right now Pueblo County's take on this here. Can you clarify that?
Well, of course. The two examples I gave, they were unique to the city of Denver and to Pueblo County. Every local jurisdiction, every county in the state has the option of allowing or not allowing marijuana facilities, which could be everything from retail stores to grow houses. They can be allowed or not allowed. And so I was only talking about Pueblo County with respect to greenhouses. And if someone wants to grow marijuana in a greenhouse or wants to grow industrial hemp in a greenhouse, well, for marijuana, they have to first of all find out if they can grow anything in a given county or city.
Okay.
And if they are allowed, the only one I know that has any restriction on greenhouse grows, it doesn't even apply to marijuana and then Pueblo County. So there is no restriction other than outright prohibition of growing that I know of anywhere in Colorado with respect to greenhouse grow operations of marijuana. And the only restriction I know about for growing hemp in a greenhouse anywhere in Colorado is Pueblo County.
Okay.
So presumably in any other county in the state, unless there is some weird zoning ordinance that I haven't heard of, I don't know of any restriction against growing in a greenhouse except in Pueblo. Let me give you a quick example of that. Is I got a call from someone a few months ago saying I'm interested in setting up a greenhouse to grow industrial hemp up, and it was a county north of Denver. So somewhere up towards Longmont, Loveland, whatever. And they said, but I'm not very far from a school. Is there a setback requirement for industrial hemp growing in a greenhouse near a school? And my answer was, not that I know of. I've never heard of any such restriction on the state level or in that particular county. So anyway, that's what people need to keep in mind, is that these are very specific examples I gave for specific counties.
Yes, and that's another reason for your presence here, is to help people be legal and not go to jail. So the attorneys are needed here. So let's continue on here, and I want to talk about the industrial hemp. There's a lot of facets to it. You got food, you got clothing, you got construction, you got paper. What part of that industry do you see moving forward the fastest here?
I'll tell you what I see is moving forward the fastest are industries that probably are not going to have such a bright future. So there's a bit of an irony there. The two biggest activities with industrial hemp going on in Colorado, where all the money is coming in,
okay,
is number one, seed production, and right, number two, okay, CBD production.
Huh.
So let's take those one at a time. Seeds. Seeds have been gold in Colorado for all the reasons I said before, that we started from zero. We didn't have an underground economy growing industrial hemp. We had nothing. And so people were by hook or by crook getting seeds into the state, either collecting them wild or smuggling them in from Canada or something, to start growing industrial hemp. And so you had a great mismatch between supply and demand. There was much, much more demand than there was supply. And so over the last couple of years, the prices for seed have been astronomical. They've been anywhere from hundreds of dollars a pound to thousands of dollars a pound. I've actually seen published prices of $2,500 for a pound of hemp seeds. Now tell me where in the world someone can pay $2,500 for a pound of hemp seeds and actually make any money off of whatever they do with those. So there has, as a result, been a lot of focus in the last couple of years on people growing hemp simply to generate more seed.
Seeds.
Partly because they needed an affordable source for themselves to be able to continue their grows. Number two, they could make a lot of money selling that stuff. That is going to change. And I would predict you're going to see a significant change starting this fall with the major field harvest this fall, that there's going to be a lot more supply of seed.
Exactly.
And simple laws of supply and demand. The price is going to go down quite a bit. Down to what? I don't know, but I would think that we're no longer going to see prices in the hundreds or thousands of dollars a pound. Maybe they'll be in the tens of dollars a pound.
Yeah.
I have
more realistic.
Well, what's more significant is when the price of seed goes down, then the cost of production goes down. And this is simple production economics. You start having the foundation for an industry that people can make a living and have a life out of. So we are starting to see the beginning of that, that there has been an exponential expansion in the growth of acreage for planting and harvesting industrial hemp. And with that, there's some changes that are going on, and it's progressing from being a mere hobby and curiosity and experiment to something where people are actually trying to run a business. So that's one thing I see in the future that is going to change, but it's going to change in maybe a way that some people would be less than happy with. They're not going to get these gold level prices anymore for seed. Yeah. There will still be a seed industry, I would think, in Colorado, but it's going to be realistic. Someone is going to probably have to have some pretty sizable acreages to have an economy of scale and size where they can actually produce seed and make some money off of it. Same thing with CBD. Okay. Yeah. Cannabidiol. And let me clarify, cannabidiol is actually a class of organic compounds. It's not one thing. And we make that mistake with both CBD and THC. We think of them as just one object, but they're actually a description of
exactly
a whole class of organic compounds, some of which may have effects that we want and some which are irrelevant. Same thing with CBD. I read somewhere there's about 85 different organic compounds that are all cannabidiols.
Yeah.
Which of those actually have some positive effects with medical applications? I don't know. You'd have to talk to an expert. We'll get someone on the show who does know about that and can tell us.
Exactly.
But anyway, here's my point, though, is that whatever the stuff is, whichever CBD compounds we really are striving after, they're gold. Mm-hmm. The prices are ridiculously high. When you look on the internet now, some of these companies that are selling online, you have to have hundreds of dollars in your pocket to buy a little tin of the stuff as a consumer product. And so there has been tremendous money pouring into Colorado into CBD operations. Because that's where the money can be made, and it certainly can be made. You'd have to be a blithering idiot not to make a lot of money in CBD now because the prices are so ridiculously high. But here's the point is that, again, supply and demand is going to bring some reality to this situation.
Exactly.
With all this expansion. And let me give you one statistic that will give you some idea, okay? Indoor growing is the primary source for CBD production, indoor growing, because you can then have very delicate, specialized plants that do nothing but produce CBD-rich plant parts. All right, 2014, there was negligible indoor growing registered in Colorado. This year, 2015, 500,000 square feet. It's gone from basically 0 to 500,000 in 1 year. And I would guarantee you that the vast majority of that indoor grow is for CBD.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know why else someone would even have plants indoors unless they were just trying to do some breeding. But there's no other commercial operation I can think of that would justify the intensity, the cost, the labor of an indoor grow other than CBD.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's been tremendous expansion. What that means is we ought to expect the price to be dropping precipitously. And when the price drops precipitously, you know what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of ma and pa CBD shops out there that are going to shut their doors because they're not going to be able to produce their commodity at a price that would cover their costs.
Exactly.
And so my prediction number one was I think the seed price is going to start dropping significantly this fall. My prediction number two is that CBD prices are going to drop. I don't know if it's going to be this year, next year, but it's going to drop. And when it does, there's going to be a shakeout in the industry, and you're going to find an awful lot of people now in the business that are going to find they can't afford to be in the business anymore. So those are two things that are big in Colorado, and the future of those is not so exciting. Okay,
yep.
What is exciting? What is coming in Colorado? Let's talk about that. I want to kind of switch to a more optimistic note. We have an institutional environment here that is almost unique in the country that is supportive of the cannabis industry. There's no other state like Colorado. We have a head start. We are industry leaders. And I would think that what that gives us is the intellectual capital and the monetary capital to be the leaders in research and development. I would like to see our universities out there on the forefront developing cultivars and developing industrial processes, developing new materials. And I think Colorado could be a leader, and I would hope to see in the future, because we have the institutional environment that will support that better than just about any other place in the country. We should be a leader in R&D in this state. Question mark. There's a lot of other things you can do with hemp, of course, and I don't know. I really don't know where Colorado is going to fall out in that. Fiber, fuel, seed oil. Here's the thing. Colorado is a harsh environment when it comes to agriculture. You want to grow alfalfa for cattle? Okay, we could do that here pretty well. Wheat? Yeah, because it's hard to kill wheat. You know, it's a durable crop. We can have some concentrated irrigation on fruit trees like Palisade peaches. We can do that. We can even have some sweet corn for the table in Olathe. We could do some specialized things like that in Colorado. Can we have a massive field crop hemp economy in this state? I kind of doubt it. I say that because I don't know how we could economically do that and produce a quality crop like you could get in a place like Kentucky. So I am skeptical. It's a question mark for me whether Colorado has really any significant future in other kinds of hemp applications. Let me move on to something a little more optimistic, and this is the last thing I'll say, is we haven't touched at all on secondary industries. And I think Colorado, again, has a leading edge on that, secondary industries. By that, I mean someone has to grow the stuff, number one. Number two, someone has to do something with the stuff. And let's face it, raw hemp is raw hemp is raw hemp. It's not a consumer good. Someone has to make consumer goods. Someone has to take those seeds and press them for oil. Someone has to take the green material and process them for CBD. Someone has to take the brown material, you know, the roots, the stems, stalks, and find something to do with that. Make paper, make fiber, process them for lignins and sugars. And we have the beginnings of those industries in Colorado, just the beginnings. There's one that's been in the news quite a bit. I think I can state the name. They'll probably appreciate it if I do. Free advertising. Pure Vision Technology, which is up in Fort Lupton. They have a pilot plant up there, and they are experimenting with processing the brown material of hemp, the stalks primarily, to extract sugars, lignins, and pulp. And so there could be some substantial secondary industries in Colorado. Even if we don't grow the stuff here, we could be the industry leaders in making hemp paper or in making hemp clothing. Why not? And again, we have the institutional environment. We have the smarts. We have all the people with experience. They're right here. And money is coming to the state. A lot of people are kicking the tires right now looking to create those secondary businesses. So I think there's a future.
I agree with you there, David. One of the industries that I'm passionate about, and I'm biased about this because it's the building industry. I want to build a hemp house. You can make hempcrete. It's not, you don't have to process all this stuff. And it's I think it's the easiest process once we get enough hemp growing, because you use what they call the hemp herd, just the part of the stalk that you kind of grind up a little bit, mix it with some lime and water. There's a process to do that. But then it becomes hempcrete, and you can build houses out of it. You can make insulation out of it. I see this maybe not as a leader right away, but it's going to be a big part of the industry itself, is building and constructing a hemp house.
Well, let's think big, right? Hempcrete is, it's kind of like CBD. It's one of those things that's all the news, all the buzz. Hey, yeah, hempcrete's great stuff. It's also incredibly crude, because all you're doing is chopping up the herd, which are the short fibers in the hemp stalk.
Right.
You got little wood chips, basically, and you're mixing those in with concrete. All right. Well, that's cool. And you can make a good product out of it. It also takes no technology to speak of.
Exactly.
And it's cheap.
Exactly.
Okay. I mean, once you have a lot of hemp growing, it doesn't take much to chop it up into a bunch of little wood bits.
And that's what I'm saying. That's what I love about it.
Well, but my point is, there's nothing special about Colorado. Okay. You have to ask yourself, what can Colorado do that other places can't? Hemp herd is one of the easiest things any idiot can do. I mean, to be crass about it. Anyone, I mean, stocks are legal. You could import stocks if you wanted to from Canada. That's legal today.
Yeah.
So you could import stocks and chop them up into herds in Massachusetts if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing special about Colorado. And so hemp herds, hempcrete, it's a great product. Don't get me wrong. I totally agree with that. But there's nothing special about it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay. And it's going to be all over the United States. And they're building homes everywhere.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, there are lots of other building materials we can think about.
Sam.
there's insulation, there's fiberboard, there's plastics. There's a lot of commodities and consumer products and building materials you can think of that could be made from hemp. And Colorado might have an edge on some of that stuff.
Okay? I agree with you.
Because they're not low technology necessarily. They might be very high technology. They might be very specialized. Maybe we could be the industry leader in hemp plastics in special insulation.
Okay, yeah, and so the construction materials I see down the line being a big industry all over the United States, not just Colorado. It's not a high-tech thing. You don't have to really know that much about it, and so forth. So that's the industry that I want because I want a hemp house. I want everything in there to be hemp house and kind of off the grid.
Okay. And what parts of your house do you want made from hemp?
Everything.
Everything.
The walls, the floors. And I'm not so sure about the roof yet, if they can do that. But the roof can be insulated. I mean, everything can be made out of hemp. It's fireproof. You can you put a torch on it. It won't burn. You can... termites don't affect it. From what I understand, that it actually starts turning into a kind of a petrified wood, and it gets harder as it goes along. And also, too, that because it's a plant, it starts sucking in the CO2 from the atmosphere. So it helps that way. So there's a lot of benefits to that. And so that's why I like it. I'm always doing something different than anybody else anyhow. So it's like, that's my nature.
Well, let me ask you a question then I don't have the answer to.
Okay.
And we'll maybe need to have someone again in a future show to talk about it. Well, why is hemp the good material to use for these construction materials? Aren't there other materials out there? I don't know if they're corn stalks or wheat straw or whatever. Is there something else we could mix with concrete that would have the same effects? Are there other materials that would make good insulation?
I really don't know. I've heard that you can mix, and I don't like this because you can mix some cement with that, but that's about all I know. And they're doing this in Europe and in England. They're building housing complexes out of nothing but hemp, you know, as far as I know. And the industry is in other parts of the world, they're doing it. So we can do it here. It's just a matter of getting enough product. It's, from what I understand, there's too much cost involved in importing it for the construction industry right now. So... but we have to get that going. So, David, is there anything else that you want to cover? Something small? We got about 3 or 4 minutes here, about 3 minutes. Any last comments?
Well, just to follow up with what you said is that we hear a lot about people saying there's 25,000 uses for hemp. I don't know where that comes from. It's one of these things, again, like
exactly.
The hemp industry is put down by, I don't know who was, John Paul Getty or Randolph Hearst or someone in the 1930s. I don't know if that's really true. It's what everyone says and they repeat it. And we hear that. There's 25,000 products. I'd like to know a little more about that. Because it's a question not only of what can we do with hemp, but what should we do? What makes sense from an economic and social standpoint to do? And we might be able to make great houses with this stuff, but what if we can't afford to? I don't have an answer for that. Yeah. Are there other materials that are better? I don't know. I'm sure somewhere in there are great uses for hemp that make sense economically, socially, environmentally. And all we know right now is things that are possible, but not necessarily things that make sense.
Okay.
We need to figure that out.
Well, yes. Well, David, thank you very much for being on the show here with me. This is Coach Freddie, inspiring people to do the things that inspire them. And I'm the host of the iHemp Revolution. It's a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. So come and visit me there. So
Have you back here, Freddie.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure here this morning. And I think we'll wrap this up.